Joining me on the telephone line right now is Reverend Denise Yarbrough. She was a member of a delegation that traveled to Israel and the occupied territories in July of 2008, meeting with human rights and peace activists, both Palestinian and Israeli. The delegation was sponsored by Interfaith Peace Builders and the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Reverend Denise Yarbrough, how are you this morning?
I'm good.
First of all, before we talk about your trip and the work of Interfaith Peace Builders, how important is it that Palestinians and Jews are able to create a sense of unity, or at the very least, be able to speak from within their own camps of justice?
I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, one thing I learned on my trip over there is that actually there are people on both sides of the conflict equally yearning for peace and equally committed to it and equally willing to take pretty big risks to get peace one way or another. At the grassroots, there's quite a lot of similar feelings about ending the conflict and finding a peaceful resolution. I mean, we came away from our trip thinking sometimes if the governments would get out of the way, the people might be able to find a way to peace. And I think it's important for Christians and Muslims, whether Palestinian or not, around the world, and Jews outside of Israel, to be equally invested in seeing peace happen there.
The question and most people's idea when it comes to the situation in the illegally occupied territories is that it's specifically a Palestinian versus Jewish question or versus the Israeli state. But as you mentioned, there are a lot of other players in the game, so to speak, a lot of different groups that have to be represented, accounted for, and have to have their voices taken into consideration. Maybe you could describe a little bit about the work and mandate of the Interfaith Peace Builders movement.
Okay, Interfaith Peace Builders is a not-for-profit organization that sort of grew out of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a Quaker peace organization, and they've done peace delegations to troubled places around the world for years, and they started going to Israel and the occupied territories, and then they, you know, the Fellowship of Reconciliation was sponsoring these things, and then they sort of broke off and formed this other group that just does Israel-Palestine. And so they do these trips to Israel-Palestine four times a year, and they're taking people over there because they want people to see the facts on the ground. I mean, they understand that outside of Israel-Palestine, and particularly in the United States, the media coverage of what happens there is fairly one-sided. And the intent of the trips is that we meet with Palestinians and with Israelis, all of whom are working for peace, so that you do see as much as possible. They try to give you both sides of the conflict, and you get right into the occupied territories and see with your own eyes what's really going on, and that's a pretty transforming experience for most people that go on it.
Since your trip to the illegally occupied territories made in July 2008, you have traveled across the country, in fact, giving presentations of the history of the situation, the realities of the current situation, and the possibilities of a one-state v2-state solution. Maybe you can tell us a brief history of the conflict, but specifically the role of Protestant Christian denominations in founding the State of Israel and the role of Christian Zionism in Israel's founding?
Yeah, well, when I did this journey myself, I mean, I'm an Episcopalian in Canada, known as Anglican, and I've been very active in Jewish-Christian relations for years and years. I'm the interfaith officer for my diocese. I do interfaith dialogue, and I'm interested in this conflict because it's sort of the one area where interfaith partners who are friendly with one another on everything else get pretty unfriendly when this thing comes up. Mm. So when I went in on that trip and then began to study the history of this whole conflict in more depth, it really hit me as an Anglican Christian the extent to which both the Episcopal Church USA, Anglicanism worldwide, and other Protestant Christian denominations who are now concerned for the Palestinians and working, you know, in their favor, need to own our own history. And in fact, for Anglicans, as it turns out, Christian Zionism was first being written and espoused as a theology as early as the 17th century, and then again in the 19th century. And then given the history of Christian anti-Judaism that sort of fed the hatred of the Nazis and enabled something like the Holocaust to happen, you know, we have to take ownership as Christians for the fact that that some of the what drove the founding of the State of Israel, the desperate need for a place for Jews to have some safety, is in part a result of our own history vis-a-vis the Jews. And then after the founding of the State of Israel, in the United States, in my own denomination and in many other Protestant denominations, you see for probably at least the first 30, 40 years of Israel's existence, you know, sort of knee-jerk, unquestioned support of Israel, in part driven by the guilt over sort of the history of how all this came to be. So part of my teaching as a Protestant Christian talking to other Protestant Christians is, you know, we've got to own our own complicity in creating a world situation that made the necessity for a state of Israel and then supporting it out of our own sense of guilt. Hmm. And now we have to sort of step in and say, okay, at this point in history, what's the right thing to do? And be concerned because Christians, our own, you know, fellow brothers and sisters in Christ over in Palestine, are leaving in large numbers because of the occupation and because of, you know, how terrible things are for them. So, you know, we've got sort of, we're really in the mix more than we'd like to think. I think a lot of Christians sort of sit back and say, oh, this is a Jewish-Muslim problem. It's not. You know, we're part of it.
I don't think that there is any denying that the legacy of the Holocaust at least played some role in the creation of the State of Israel. How much of a factor is it that countries after the Second World War were not necessarily too inclined to have Jewish refugees arriving within their borders? How much did that prejudice and discrimination actually lead to the creation of Israel?
Well, I'm sure it helped. I mean, clearly, if other countries in the world, the United States among them, had willingly taken Jewish refugees, there might not have been anywhere near as much of a desperation to have, you know, some place in the world where Jewish refugees would know that they can go and be safe. I mean, clearly, it's a part of the larger picture. And, you know, as an American, I have to say, you know, our own country didn't do very well there.
Well, that's part of history that maybe a lot of people, a large number of those people actually involved within the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that's a part of American history and European history that a lot of people are not aware of.
Right, or if they know it, they sort of learned it somewhere and conveniently forget it when this conflict is being discussed.
Well said. You are a reverend in the Episcopalian Church or the Anglican Church. The House of Bishops is the deciding body for the Episcopalian Church.
Well, in the United States, the Episcopal Church is governed by our General Convention, and there are two houses. There's the House of Bishops and a House of Deputies. The House of Deputies is made up of lay people and priests and deacons, and then the House of Bishops is bishops. And we meet every 3 years in a convention. We just had one last summer. And at that convention, we pass resolutions on a whole variety of things. And we have passed resolutions for the last 40 years on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in one form or another. And we had, frankly, last summer, a very strong statement that I thought was excellent, come out of the House of Deputies, sort of calling, when it's, you know, the Episcopal Church writing to the government saying, we call on you to, you know, support the rights of Palestinians, to support, you know, we support Barack Obama's attempts to, you know, make peace over there. It was a very strong statement, and the House of Bishops did not pass it. The House of Deputies did, bishops didn't, because they felt it was, you know, too strong of a statement. Mm. And here again is the legacy of decades of the church trying to make all the horrible things the church has done for centuries against Jews right, by being deeply committed to Jewish-Christian dialogue and the sensitivity on the part of many of these bishops that American Jews are going to take it badly if the church comes out with a statement that sounds like it's against Israel, because there's still a tendency to equate criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism, which isn't, they're not equal, but there is that fear. So the bishops backed off and they didn't pass it.
It sounds like there has been so much discrimination against the Jewish people that the desire to make up for all that past discrimination is translating into now discrimination against the Palestinian people. Who's going to be the next group to be discriminated against after justice is given to the Palestinians? Who's going to be the next group after that? Who's going to be the next group after that? We can't keep playing catch-up with humanity.
No, I know, and it's, you know, sort of the irony of, you know, one refugee population has created another refugee population. But I really think, too, I mean, what was an eye-opener for me was that so few people in the United States, particularly people that want to talk about this issue, have actually been over there. I mean, it is a remarkable experience to actually go there. I've even spoken since I've gotten back with some of my Jewish colleagues and friends who are very, very strongly pro-Israel, and, you know, they flinch a little when I speak in a sort of what they consider a pro-Palestinian way, and then I'll say to them, well, have you been to the West Bank? No. Have you seen the settler roads versus the Palestinian roads? No. Have you walked through a checkpoint? No. So, you know, they haven't actually seen it. And that, to, I attribute some of their unwillingness to understand the depth of feeling on this situation to the fact that they haven't seen it with their own eyes.
In an aside, that's an interesting metaphor for the fact that a lot of people who are criticizing the United Nations Goldstone report right now are actually people who haven't read the report.
They haven't read it, and they haven't been there, and then they criticize it.
The movement right now globally to try to move towards obtaining some sort of justice for the Palestinian people is called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. The House of Bishops of the Episcopalian Church refused to endorse the BDS movement. May I ask you personally, you are a reverend in the Episcopalian Church, but where do you personally stand on the theory of a nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as a way to obtain justice for the Palestinian people?
Personally, I support it. I'm all in favor of nonviolent resistance. I think it's a legitimate form of nonviolent resistance. I think, you know, we've got a good precedent in what happened in South Africa, and I think we need to do it. And I attribute my church's unwillingness to step forward as strongly as I wish it could on this issue, again, to exactly the same thing I mentioned before. I think there's just a real fear of alienating Jewish dialogue partners that we've had for years and relationships that we've built for years with Jews, which is a very important thing to the church. And so they're unwilling to do something that they know are going to make the American Jews angry. And most American Jews are not thrilled when you start talking about boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I think it's very much a sort of touchy political issue. Personally, I'm completely in favor of BDS. In fact, when we were over there, we were meeting with Palestinians who were very much involved in that whole movement.
The idea of alienating Jewish dialogue partners is not unique to the House of Bishops and the Episcopalian Church. I think that's the reasoning for a lot of organizations that otherwise would support a BDS movement. Is it going to take voices from within Jewish communities themselves worldwide to vocally state that the State of Israel does not represent them and they are not necessarily in favor of what the State of Israel is inflicting on the Palestinian people?
I think not just the House of Bishops, but I mean, there's lots of Episcopalians probably who are equally squeamish about BDS. And it's absolutely critical that American Jews in particular, who don't agree with policies of the Israeli government, find their voice and are willing to speak out about it, because otherwise many folks will continue to feel as though if they criticize Israel, they're going to be labeled anti-Semitic, and they don't want to be labeled that way. Mm. I mean, I know here in my community in Rochester, we have an exceedingly active interfaith community, and there are some Jews here who are very active in some of the Jewish peace movements here that are, you know, critical of the State of Israel, but they're definitely the minority. And so it is hard, because most of the mainstream Jews who are active in interfaith stuff tend to be very pro-Israel, and it makes it very difficult to have dialogue. So the more Jews in America who can be a part, I mean, there's the J Street organization and Michael Lerner's Network for Spiritual Progressives and Tikkun. I mean, there are groups of Jews around who are beginning to speak up, and that's really critical.
I think that it's not just within the United States that Jewish people are speaking up. It is throughout the world. There's been increasing voices that I've heard referring to the fact that the State of Israel cannot necessarily represent Jewish people worldwide, specifically because what it's doing to the Palestinians is not something that they would want to have done to themselves, which is basically the guiding principle of the Torah itself.
Right, exactly.
One final question for you. What would your advice be for Palestinian people within the illegally occupied territories, Palestinian people throughout the world who see these tragedies and these humiliations played out, I mean, day after day after day? What would your advice be for the Palestinian people?
Oh, it's hard to give them advice, given that they are living in such insufferable conditions. But I guess my plea to them would be to continue to resist nonviolently as much as they can, and be voices for peace as much as they can, and that they should know that there are many of us outside the occupied territories who understand their plight and are working as hard as we can in our parts of the world to try to make things change for them. I mean, they just got to keep enduring and maintain some hope in what one would, you know, has to admit is often a seemingly hopeless situation. I have great admiration for the courage and the perseverance of so many of them. I mean, they're an inspiration to lots of us.
As well they should be. Reverend Denise Yarborough, it has been an absolute pleasure and very enlightening speaking with you this morning, and I honestly hope that we will be speaking again in the not-too-distant future.
Okay, thanks very much.